Welcome to ID the Future. I'm Andrew McDermott. What happens when people take to the streets to march under the banner of science? How do you sort out the truth from the misconceptions and lies? Is science in danger, and if so, from whom? And while we're at it, what is science, and does it belong to everyone? Discovery Institute and the Heritage Foundation came together to answer these questions in an event called March for Science, or March for Scientism, Understanding the Real Threats to Science in America. The panel discussion included Stephen Meyer, Wesley J. Smith, Jay Richards, and Marla Lewis. On a handful of episodes, we bring you highlights of the event in bite-sized segments. Today, editor of The Stream and senior fellow at the Discovery Institute, Jay Richards, discusses what he sees as the real threats to science in America.
Let me just finish up very briefly with a brief discussion of the rhetorical use of this idea of consensus. All three other panelists have actually used this term. We're all familiar with it. Now, what's the rhetorical function of consensus when applied? Normally, we hear this. It has something to do with climate change, but it's used for all sorts of very scientific ideas. What's the function of that? What's the purpose of invoking consensus? It's almost always, presumably, to imply that the experts who are best suited to be able to make a judgment about a particular idea are in general or overwhelming agreement about that subject. So the function of invoking consensus is essentially to silence skeptical doubts from non-specialists, and in particular from non-scientists. And this sets up a problem because, of course, there's public funding of science. Half of what the March for Science is about is the worry of that. So what that means is that there needs to be, for a healthy scientific culture and also a healthy funding culture for science, is a basic public trust in the institutions of science itself. So what happens if the public at large starts to become skeptical about various scientific claims? That's the dilemma, and I think that's what's at stake in deciding this question. And the problem is that consensus can mean a couple of different things. I mean, if you look up the word in Merriam-Webster, here's what it says. It says, consensus means both general agreement and group solidarity in sentiment and belief. Right? And that's the problem right there, right? So what we want to know is, okay, if there's a consensus about hydrogen being lighter than helium, is it based on groupthink? Is it based on just sort of a common judgment, or is it based on a community actually looking objectively at the evidence and then coming to a rational conclusion? You don't know. There can be a consensus in both cases. We know from the history of science, for instance, especially in the Soviet Union, that consensus is often actually politically enforced. But consensus can also be enforced in much more subtle, but I think equally powerful ways. Social pressure, denial or threats of tenure and funding, simply cocktail party discomfort. These things, I think, in some ways can enforce what is essentially a sociological function of consensus, in some ways, at least as powerfully as the gulags could in a different time and place. And so really what we want to know, on the one hand, is this proposed consensus, is it actually based on an objective evaluation by the relevant experts of the evidence, or is it some kind of groupthink that is being fobbed off on us? There's a sort of great quote from Andrew Coyne in a piece about this. He says, what we want to do is be able to distinguish, as he puts it, between genuine authority and mere received wisdom. How do we tell crankish imperviousness to evidence from legitimate skepticism? Because, of course, that's always the other side. There's always this crank somewhere available immediately online that doubts any particular scientific idea. And so the fact that they're skeptics is not itself an argument against the proposed consensus. And so what is the non-scientist to do? What I would argue is that the best way for a non-specialist to approach this question is by evaluating carefully the sociological context in which the proposed consensus was formed. How was it formed? You may not know anything about fluid dynamics. You may not know anything about dendrochronology or solar physics or any of the relevant scientific subdisciplines that you'd need to know to be able to have a scientific evaluation of the evidence, say, for climate change. But you can evaluate the sociological features that gave rise to the supposed consensus in itself. And so what I did is I've come up with a list. It's a growing list of 12 ways or 12 reasons you might want to doubt a so-called scientific consensus. I won't give all of those to you here today, but for those of you who are here in the auditorium, Heritage Foundation has printed the whole list out so you can grab a copy on your way out, or shameless promotion, you can actually see this essay at stream.org. So let me just give you a few of these sort of examples. Okay, so these are essentially a checklist, not just for climate science, but any proposed consensus, whether it's a political consensus or scientific consensus. And my argument would be that the more of these things that build up, the more justified you are in being skeptical of the claimed consensus, even if you don't know anything about the scientific details. The first is when different claims get bundled together. This is, I think, a sort of key feature of the climate science debate. Anyone that on any particular day, in fact, my entry under my name at Wikipedia claims that I'm a climate skeptic. Well, no one's a climate skeptic. And in fact, I'm not even skeptical about the human role in climate change or global warming. But what happens is that if you raise questions about any of the kind of bundle of ideas, logically independent ideas that travel under climate science, you get called a denier skeptic. So at the very least, you could say, with respect to climate change, there's the first sort of empirical question, are we in a warming trend globally on average? It's presumably an empirical and a historical question. What's the cause of that? Or what are the causes of that? And sub-question in there would be, what is the role of human activity? That's a different question. It'd be based on entirely different evidence. So an empirical question of what's happening, it just simply isn't the same question as why is it happening? And you might be really certain about the first question and a little iffy about the second question. And there's the third question, is it bad? It's the evaluative and political question, right? Are we in a warming trend? Is it likely on balance that that's going to be a bad thing for the human race and for life, or a good thing? That doesn't tend to get asked, but in fact, that's a relevant question. And then finally, there's the policy question. Let's say you think we're in a warming trend. It's going to lead to sort of catastrophic climate change. Human activities, in particular, greenhouse gas emissions are the primary cause of that. And it's going to be catastrophic to human life. That tells you nothing about the best set of policies to actually solve the problem and to have the greatest benefits and the least cost. Those are all entirely separate questions. There is no human alive that's an expert in all those questions. In fact, most climate scientists, people like Michael Mann, a dendrochronologist, you might be the world's greatest expert in tree rings and know absolutely nothing about solar physics. And so the very nature of this particular debate means that no one actually has all the relevant information. And so my first of the list of when to doubt a scientific consensus would be when logically separate issues are almost always bundled up together. And you're essentially asked, sign on or sign off. If you doubt any part of the package, you're a denier. That would be one reason why you might want to be a bit skeptical. That's only one issue. I'm not saying any single one of these is dispositive. What I'm saying is that the more of these things that pile up, the more rational a non-scientist or non-specialist is in thinking something skeptical rather than simply assenting to the idea. Let me give you just several others that are sort of related. When scientists are pressured to toe the party line, I first started writing about this particular issue in 2009, right before the Copenhagen UN Climate Conference and the so-called ClimateGate scandal, which was the release of many thousands of emails and documents by leading climate scientists, in which it became clear what those of us that follow the climate blogosphere had known for years, which is that the peer review process, the process of getting grants, are highly cliquish and highly controlled. In fact, scientists that are willing to stick their necks out and raise any particular skeptical question, it's sort of the best possible way to get yourself denied tenure or to get your science funding pulled. If you're a young scientist, in fact, young scientists that are interested in these issues are almost always advised, look, if you've got skeptical thoughts, don't say anything about it. This is another of the issues on which I think can lead to some skepticism. Are the scientists who raise skeptical questions, young scientists without tenure? Or are they old and accomplished scientists at the end of their careers or after they've retired? Nothing to lose and actually just more interested than the truth, and they're probably living off a pension. On almost any issue in which you find that sociological dynamic, I would argue you have reason to think some kind of social pressure is at play in the scientific community. In other words, the consensus might be more based on social pressure and cliquishness than on an objective and independent evaluation of the scientific evidence. You see this in the sort of details of the peer-reviewed process, especially in 2009 with the so-called ClimateGate scandal. And you sort of Google this and you get spades of information on it. Let me give you just a couple of more and then we'll stop. When consensus is declared before it actually exists. Try to remember a time in which the question of climate change was not declared a consensus. In 2009, Al Gore, of course, had declared that there was no debate actually around, but in 1999, he claimed there was no debate, that there was a consensus. What's interesting is that in his 2009 statement on this, he claimed that as late as 2002, there was still an actual debate, but there was no longer any debate. And in fact, but several years before 2002, he himself was saying the debate was already settled. And in fact, this issue almost always is accompanied, almost instantaneously, by claims of consensus. It was the same thing in the 1970s with global cooling in 1977, 1976. Media reports said virtually all scientists agree on that. When you hear that kind of language, science says, or scientists agree, well, first of all, science doesn't say anything. It's an institution. But when you hear scientists say, you ought to think, okay, which ones? Is that all of them? These are the kinds of signs that I would argue you want to look for to see, okay, is this based on an objective evaluation of the evidence, or is this actually some kind of clique or social dynamic? Last couple, when the scientific issue is used to justify profound economic and policy changes. Now, I'm not saying if something has policy implications, you ought to doubt it. What I'm saying is that when all of these issues pile up and then you discover that the decision or your particular view on this issue will hinge all sorts of very important economic questions, say changing the global economy, then you want really, really solid evidence. That's how the late Carl Sagan said. He said, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Claims that if you took them seriously would require reorienting the economy of the world ought to have extraordinary evidence, is a perfectly reasonable request. And when skeptical questions are raised, people are shouted down. Instead of the evidence and the arguments being made, I would argue that's a very good sign that you ought to doubt it. And then one final instance in which I would argue that you ought to doubt the claims of a scientific consensus is when you keep hearing about a scientific consensus. That itself should be a sign of skepticism. Have you ever heard of this consensus that hydrogen is lighter than helium? Or the consensus that the Earth rotates around the sun? Right? Or that bacteria sometimes cause human sickness? No, you don't. Right? You never hear that. Why? You don't need to. There's absolutely no rhetorical force to it because the evidence can be tested easily. All sorts of things from chemistry can be tested independently by anyone with a lab where the experiment can be run. Climate science, by its very nature, simply doesn't submit to that level of certainty. And so you should expect, if anything, modesty on the part of not only the scientific community, but the public intellectuals and advocates who advocate for these particular views. You should expect modesty. But if instead the experts try to silence you with an invocation of consensus, I would argue that gives you reason to doubt it.
That was Jay Richards on a panel event co-hosted by Discovery Institute and the Heritage Foundation, discussing the real threats to science in America. For more on these topics, check out our written coverage of the March for Science at The Stream. You'll find it at stream.org/tag/ScienceWeek2017. For ID the Future, I'm Andrew McDermott. Thanks for listening. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.